coming up on this episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
There's a myth that we have to eat grains to be healthy. We do not. We do not need to eat them. Now, you can eat them, but basically don't buy the propaganda that we need them.
It seems that every day more and more patients come into my office bringing ever-increasing amounts of healthcare information with them. And I love it when this happens because it means people are taking ownership of their health. But it also means I have to stay on the top of my game. So as a healthcare practitioner, how do you make sure that when a patient walks into your office and says, hey, I really want a Dutch Complete or a GI Map, that you have the right answers and tools? The answer is Rupa University. They are the number one educational institute for root cause medicine with over 20,000 practitioners a year learning about functional and specialty lab testing. Not only do they have absolutely free live classes hosted every week, but they bring in industry experts to teach in-depth six-week boot camps on all the most popular functional tests. If you want to level up your knowledge of functional lab testing, make sure to visit RupaUniversity.com. You know that my goal is to live to be 120 and thrive while doing it. Well, I'm always looking for tools and strategies to help me get there. And I want to share with you one of the tools that I found and that I love, a nutritional supplement called AG1. AG1 supports your body's universal needs like nutrient replenishment, gut optimization, stress management, and immune support. By giving your body the nutrients it can easily absorb and utilize, AG1 supports your daily performance and elevates your baseline health. I drink AG1 every day, and ever since I started, I have consistently felt better and had more energy throughout the day. I just add a scoop to my water in the morning and feel the effects all day long. If you want to take ownership of your health, it starts with AG1. Try AG1 now and you'll get a free welcome kit that includes a shaker bottle, canister, and metal scoop, along with 10 free travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/Hyman. That's drinkag1.com/Hyman. Check it out. Now, let's get back to this week's episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
Hi, this is Lauren Feehan, one of the producers of the Doctor's Pharmacy podcast. Bread, grains, and flour are some of the most common foods and ingredients that many people eat multiple times throughout the day. But the modern grains you're eating aren't the same as what your grandparents ate. Gluten in many grains can cause irritation to your gut, leading to issues such as leaky gut or even autoimmune disease. In today's episode, we feature conversations from the Doctor's Pharmacy about the link between eating a high-grain diet and health conditions, including autoimmunity. Dr. Hyman answers your most asked questions about grains and why you may want to rethink eating bread. He then speaks with Maggie Ward about gluten, and finally with Dr. Terry Walls about why individuals with autoimmune conditions would want to remove gluten from their diet. Let's dive in.
There is no such thing as an essential carbohydrate. There are essential fatty acids, right, the omega-3s, and there are essential amino acids, which we need in large doses from protein. But there is no such thing as an essential carbohydrate. Even the National Academy of Sciences Dietary Reference Index says there's no biological requirement for carbohydrates. Now, that's not to say they're not okay to eat, they're not good for us. I mean, vegetables are carbohydrates, broccoli is carbohydrate, there's carbohydrates in nuts. It's not that they're bad, but it depends on the type of carbohydrate. So first of all, there's a myth that we have to eat grains to be healthy. We do not. We do not need to eat them. Now, you can eat them, and we'll talk about how and why, but basically, don't buy the propaganda that we need them. In fact, for most of human history, we haven't had grains. Until the agricultural revolution 10,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago, we never had any grains, we never had any beans. We basically were hunters and gatherers. Our bodies worked very well without them. And yes, there are plenty of vitamins, minerals, fiber, nutrients in whole grains, but you can get all that from other sources, including vegetables, fruits, seeds, nuts, and other foods that don't have the same baggage as grains. Now, there are some cases where, you know, patients and people can eat grains and be healthy, but I'm going to talk about how to be very careful about it. And particularly people who do not do well with them are people who have insulin resistance, prediabetes, type 2 diabetes, people who are overweight, obese. Now, how many people is that? Well, 1 in 2 Americans is prediabetes or diabetes, 75% overweight, 93% are metabolic and healthy. So maybe 6% of the population can tolerate them and not get into trouble. I mean, that's not too good. So I think we'd be very smart about what we're doing and actually talk about what kind of grains, how we're eating them, and how different grains affect us differently. Now, in terms of whole grains, that's just a bunch of BS, right? If you look at the marketing propaganda from the food industry, it's talking about whole grain flours, we think it's healthy. It's just a bunch of nonsense. For example, I want you to read labels carefully so you can tell whether what you're buying is actually truly healthy or not, or is just marketing hype. For example, you can get a whole grain cookie crisp cereal. Sounds great. Whole grain cookie crisp cereal. Well, the cookie crisp doesn't sound healthy, but it's got 22 grams of sugar, right? How much is that? That's 5 teaspoons, 5.5 teaspoons of sugar in your serving of cereal that you give your kid in the morning. Not a health food, right? Not a health food. Just because they put a few flakes of whole grain flour doesn't make it healthy, right? Also understand your body. Below the neck, your body can't tell the difference between a bowl of cornflakes and a bowl of sugar. Sugar and flour are the same in the body. I mean, actually, flour might be a little worse because it has only glucose, whereas sugar has fructose and glucose, which are different metabolism, but they're both bad. basically eating 2 slices of whole wheat bread can raise your blood sugar more than having 2 tablespoons of table sugar. Think about that. So whenever you eat something containing whole wheat flour, you might as well be mainlining sugar, unless certain caveats are taken into consideration, which we'll talk about in a minute. So also, you're not eating the same grains that we used to eat, right? We're not eating ancient grains, heirloom grains. We're eating these new hybrids that are developed. For example, like dwarf wheat. Dwarf wheat was a very important innovation in agriculture, led to the Nobel Prize being awarded to the scientists who were able to hybridize, not GMO, but hybridize wheat so that it was short and stubby, not tall and thin, and that it produced much more starch and much more drought resistant, much more resilient, and could help, you know, feed the world, which all sounds great, except for one thing. There's a starch that's produced there called amylopectin A, which is a super starch. It's the worst. And it's basically the wheat we're eating today. Not only that, they spray it with glyphosate often at the end to desiccate it so it's easier to harvest. And basically just bad news. And the new hybrids have higher amounts of gluten in them and more likely to cause autoimmune disease. So basically, we want to be very careful. Now, heirloom strains like Zia wheat, like I was talking about, might be okay, or einkorn wheat, or other types of whole grains like farro, which have gluten, might be okay. But they're more ancient grains that people are not consuming. And by the way, they're not eating, like I said, whole wheat berries, right? I used to make, you know, wheat berry something, like we'd have wheat berries in salad. We'd cook them up and do that, but that's not that common, right? So we have so much flour. It's mostly dwarf wheat. It's mostly sprayed with glyphosate. It's super high glycemic index, high gluten antibodies. Definitely not helpful. Definitely not helpful, and definitely not something you should be consuming. Even healthy grains may be problems. Like if you over consume grains that are quote healthy grains, even if it's like amaranth or brown rice, right? When they turn into flour, they're basically pulverizing it and the surface area is much higher and it's quickly absorbed and it spikes your blood sugar. So even if it sounds like, oh, I'm having brown rice bread or something, it's actually maybe even worse. So make sure you're really smart about what you're reading. Look at the labels very carefully and look at where the food is on the label. If it's a, by the way, I think most people shouldn't eat food with labels. I mean, it basically, you know, it's a can, it has sardines and olive oil, salt, fine. But if it's, you know, has 45 ingredients, you should just not eat, put it back. What about oatmeal? Oatmeal is such a health food, right? Beep, not really. Yeah. It actually raises your blood sugar, and most of the oatmeal we eat is actually pretty refined oatmeal. It's not steel cut oats. It's not whole oats. Those might be a little bit better. But when you eat oatmeal, it basically spikes your sugar. In one study, they looked at kids who had oatmeal, eggs, or steel cut oats, basically same calories, right? Same calories. And the kids were a little overweight. And they basically said, okay, if you're hungry, just tell us and we'll give you food. And when they looked and they put a catheter in their vein and basically draw their blood every hour and watch what they ate. And the kids who ate oatmeal had 81% more food in the day because they were hungrier. And their blood sugar spiked more. Their insulin spiked more. They had more adrenaline, more cortisol, more stress hormones. So basically eating oatmeal is stressful for the body and led to all these things that cause weight gain. So I'm not a big fan of starting the day with oatmeal. Now, it depends if you have whole oats and you put nuts in there and fat and other things, it slows the absorption, it might be okay. But just your Quaker oats, definitely not. No. What about gluten? No. You all heard about I'm gluten-free, gluten's bad for you and this and that. And generally, it's pretty new in the human diet. Especially the dwarf wheat, which I mentioned, which has much more gliadin proteins that are much more inflammatory. Now, some people are fine if you're healthy, if you don't have a leaky gut, Not everybody's sensitive. About a third of the population has the gene for celiac. About 1% of the population has celiac. And by the way, there's been about a 400% true increase in celiac disease in 50 years, right? Because of the damage we've done to our gut. And part of that damage is from the new wheat and the gluten and the antibiotics and other things. But basically, we have a society that is now rampant with gluten sensitivity, which probably affects up to 20% of the population, whereas true celiac is about 1%. But your body really doesn't know what to do with gluten, right? And celiac disease is an autoimmune disease, and it can cause over 50, maybe 100 different diseases like type 1 diabetes, like rheumatoid arthritis, like osteoporosis, like colitis, like iron deficiency anemia. I mean, the list goes on because of how it affects your gut. Now, a lot of us, like I said, have this non-celiac gluten sensitivity, and basically our body starts reacting inflammation, and so we don't want that. And sometimes it's worth doing a trial of a gluten elimination diet, basically to see how your body does. Do it for 3 weeks, see what happens. Add gluten back, see what happens. You might be fine. For example, I don't have a reaction to gluten. I do to dairy, but I don't have a reaction to gluten. I've checked, I don't have antibodies. My gut was okay. So basically, I can eat gluten, but I don't eat that much of it because it's mostly flour, right? I don't eat the wheat berries. But there are other grains. Now, one of the problems is that Dr. Alessio Fasano at Harvard, the world expert in celiac and gluten, basically talks about how everybody who eats gluten has some little damage to their gut because gluten increases something called zonulin. Zonulin is a protein that produces in our bodies, which actually causes damage to our gut lining, creates a leaky gut, little tight junctions, which are like Legos that are stuck together, come apart. It's only one cell thick between you and a sewer. And then you end up flooding your body with all these foreign proteins and antibodies. I mean, foreign proteins and antigens, and also bacterial toxins and proteins that are really quite bad. And so basically, 60 to 70% of our immune system is right under our gut. So a lot of our inflammatory diseases are caused by gut. I mean, I was reading about insomnia recently that there's been a big correlation between dysbiosis, imbalances in the gut flora, leaky gut, and sleep disorders. So even sleep, for example, may be a factor. Now, when we have these leaky gut, food particles, antigens, microbes leak in, quote, leak through our protective lining, they activate our gut immune system, and that creates systemic inflammation. It can cause obesity, heart disease, cancer, dementia, diabetes, but also obviously allergies, skin disorders, asthma, and autoimmune diseases. So I think everybody with gluten has some degree of leaky gut, but some people kind of manage it and can tolerate it. Other people can't. And so I think we have to really take stock of the fact that gluten and celiac is a real problem, and if you don't look for it, you don't find it. I started a company called founded I co-founded a company called functionhealth.com, where we do full celiac testing. Often your doctor won't order it, or they won't do the right one, so you can go to functionhealth.com and learn more. So now, gluten-free, by the way, isn't necessarily healthy either. Gluten-free cake and cookies is still cake and cookies, right? So remember, we had fat-free yogurt. Well, fat-free yogurt, your Yoplait fat-free yogurt has more sugar per ounce than a can of soda, right? Doesn't make it healthy, right? Remember, what we call them, Snackwell cookies, right? Fat-free, but full of sugar doesn't mean they're healthy. So just because it says gluten-free doesn't mean it's healthy. I saw a package of potato chips the other day that had gluten-free on the cover, right? Coca-Cola is gluten-free. Doesn't mean it's healthy. So the word gluten-free doesn't mean anything. It just means that the gluten's not there, and that's fine if you're celiac, but it doesn't mean it's a health food. And usually it's replaced with something more harmful in terms of maybe other refined grains that are more glycemic in nature, additives, tons of sugar, high glycemic flours, refined oils. So just remember, gluten-free cookie is still a cookie. And by the way, not all grains are bad in food. What the heck should I talk about? The ones that I'm concerned about, like oatmeal, corn, wheat. And yes, gluten's a real issue for people. Other forms of grains are not so problematic, right? So, for example, quinoa is a South American grain that's very, very helpful. That actually has a lot of protein in it, has good amino acids in it. It's problematic because we're taking the food from the indigenous people in South America, which is their staple. Now they can't even afford it, so that's a whole nother problem. Even other grains, for example, like Himalayan tartary buckwheat, which is from the Himalayas, super dense in nutrients, 132 phytochemicals, lots of protein, lots of fiber, lots of magnesium, lots of minerals. That can be fine. So I was going to make pancakes from Himalayan buckwheat flour, but we don't want to eat all the traditional grains we're eating that are in Twinkies and cookies, pizza, not good. So also, you can start to make other things with, like, for you know, I make the buckwheat pancakes, which are actually quite good. You can make buckwheat bread. So you can, and by the way, buckwheat's not even a grain, so it's a flour. What about bread? Do we have to give up bread? Well, no, not necessarily. There's lots of bread made with whole kernel grains, not just the flour. Or no flour, you can make it with nuts and seeds. Rye bread, for example, rye can be healthy. That's gluten for many people, but it can be problematic, but actually is super helpful in many ways. And in Germany, I went to visit a friend once, and they had a meat slicer in their house. And I'm like, well, what's that for? Like, you know, what they have in a deli to slice the, you know, whatever, the meats. And they're like, oh, that's to cut our bread. I'm like, what do you mean? Yeah, we can't cut it with a knife. It's too dense. So literally this fresh bread comes out. And basically my rule for bread is if you can stand on it and it doesn't squish, you can probably eat it. So basically if it's made from whole kernels and it's made from nuts and seeds, other types of flours, it can be actually fine. I have recipes in my book, Food, What the Heck Should I Cook, for non-flour breads, and they can be quite delicious. And how often should you eat whole grains? And by the way, when you're eating grains, only whole grains, right? Get away from flours, whole grains. So brown rice, quinoa, black rice, you know, stay away from flours, but eat whole grains, right? Brown rice, black rice, red rice, quinoa, other grains can be fine. Farro, barley, if you want, if you're not gluten sensitive. And even, you know, Himalayan tari buckwheat, it's not something you eat as a whole grain, but that flour is okay because it doesn't have a high glycemic load. And you mix it with eggs and other things, it can be great. So you should be eating a lot, particularly if you're diabetic, pre-diabetic, and some resistant, overweight. You probably want to cut them out for a while until you're healthy, and then you can add them back. Probably, you know, half a cup a day is fine. I think that's okay if it's whole grain, probably once a day. So what are the things that I talk about? And it can be, again, not the main dish, right? You know, in some countries, they do eat a lot of grains, right? In China, oh, they eat rice and they're thin. Or, you know, in India, they eat a lot of rice. Well, you know, I just, you know, came back from Nepal and, you know, they were eating a lot of rice, white rice. But these guys were literally carrying 70, 80 pounds on their back up and down the Himalayan mountains all day long. So they needed the energy. But if you're not doing that, I would stick away from a lot of grains. Buckwheat, the Himalayan tari buckwheat's my favorite. You can go to bigbolthealth.com and learn more about that. Whole kernel rye for not gluten sensitive. Quinoa, also it's not a grain, it's actually a pseudo grain. Black rice, red rice, sorghum, teff, millet, amaranth, all can be great. What about white rice? White rice is something that, you know, a lot of cultures eat. Now, white rice doesn't always have to be that. There's a research that's been done on white rice that if you cool it and then you reheat it, not too hot, but just if you basically cook it and even potatoes, and then put it in the fridge, let it get cold, and then kind of reheat it gently, it actually causes something to be produced called resistant starch, which helps resist the digestion of it. It's lower glycemic. It actually can help with your microbiome. It's great for as a prebiotic and maybe even improve metabolism. So you can use that. So what grains should I avoid if I might be gluten sensitive? Well, all the gluten containing grains, wheat, barley, rye, spelt, kamut, farro, bulgur, oats, semolina, couscous, any refined grains, all these you want to avoid. I think, you know, grains can be part of a healthful diet, but only if you're metabolically healthy and only if you're eating the right grains and only if they're whole grains. So in general, we need to recognize grains for what they are. They're a recreational treat, not a staple. An occasional indulgence, fine. Not an everyday thing for me. I'm not a fan of most grains. It's fine to include them small amounts in your diet, but only if they're whole grains, only if they're organic, only if they're gluten-free. Yeah, by the way, if you're not gluten sensitive, you may be able to tolerate a little of the healthier gluten grains, but for most people, they're problematic. And if you're wondering who should not be eating them, well, if you have type 2 diabetes or high blood sugar, pre-diabetes, if you have weight issues, cravings, if you have food sensitivities, digestive issues, autoimmune diseases, if you feel bloated after you eat, our blood tests show that you have high levels of inflammation markers, probably not great to eat a lot of grains at all.
Hey everyone, it's Dr. Mark here. I am a big fan of bone broth because it's a game changer when it comes to gut healing and skin health. With so many bone broths on the market now, it can kind of be tough to choose, but let me simplify it for you. Fond Bone Broth checks all the boxes when it comes to choosing the healthiest bone broth. They only use fresh organic herbs, spices, and vegetables, grass-fed and finished beef bones, and pasteurized chicken bones exclusively from regenerative farms. They never use powders or concentrates like many bone broths out there. And their bone broth is slow simmered in stainless steel kettles for 18 hours and is free of gluten, sugar, carbs, and fats, but rich in collagen, protein, and essential trace minerals. On top of that, they package their bone broth in reusable glass jars, and their entire process is 100% free of plastic and aluminum. You'll be hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and sustainable bone broth. Fond Bone Broth is the only verified regenerative bone broth on the market. With every jar of bone broth purchased, you are supporting U.S. regenerative farmers who are focused on reversing the damage that decades of industrial farming has done to our soil. You're not only choosing the healthiest bone broth for you, but the healthiest bone broth for the planet as well. And trust me when I say, Fond Bone Broths are also out of this world delicious. As they say at Fond, handcrafted for health and sipped for pleasure. Head over to fondbonebroth.com and use the code Dr. Mark to receive 20% off your order. That's FondBonebroth.com and use the code Dr. Mark. And be sure to download their new guide on reclaiming your health with bone broth in 2024. And now let's get back to this week's episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
So gluten is the most predominant protein that's in some grains, wheat being the most common one. So wheat, rye, barley, although wheat also encompasses things like spelt and kamut and
farro and triticale.
Yeah. Okay. So there are other grains within that
even
family.
Oats is often have
and even oats. And we'll talk a little bit more about oats because they can go either way. But, you know, it's mostly wheat that we eat in the form of bread, crackers, pasta, right? All the flour that comes in through our diet, we're getting gluten in many foods. And it's not necessarily a bad thing for everyone, but it is really the most common food sensitivity. And something we see in so many people that we work with here at the Ultra Wellness Center. So I really wanted to kind of dive through it a little bit more of what is the big picture and who needs to be careful and how we do
that. Yeah. So Maggie, is this like, how come gluten's all of a sudden a thing? Because, you know, when I went to medical school 30 years ago, I was like, I had celiac disease. And
right.
Maybe a few people had it. It was like very small percent of the population, 1% of the population. But now you've got, you know, like maybe 20% or more having gluten sensitivity and all these issues.
Right.
We have a 400% increase in celiac disease in the last 50 years. It's been proven by research. It's not just a fad. What's going on?
Right. Well, I think when it started, right, it was the prevalence was thought to be a lot lower and we know it to be a lot more common. I think it's still a minority of the population. It's missed and underdiagnosed quite a bit because, yes, in medical school, you learn about celiac disease. But I think the thinking is that for someone to have it, they would have, you know, diarrhea all day, every day. And we know that.
And
we know that's not the case. I mean, I've had some people with no digestive issues and come back positive on a celiac panel. But for them, they had rheumatoid arthritis or another autoimmune condition going on. It just was presenting differently. So I think it, for that reason, doctors aren't always screening for it.
Yeah.
But so there's that issue of celiac. But then I always kind of describe it as a spectrum. There is a gluten sensitivity spectrum out there, mm-hmm. and many of us fall somewhere on the spectrum. Most of the folks that come to see us, I think, fall on the end of the spectrum where, you know, it may not be celiac. We can't really determine that based off the testing we've done, but they have to pretty much treat themselves as if. So that's, I think, where
it's not an on or off phenomenon. You
right.
have it or you don't. Because traditional medicine, you go to the doctor, they go, well, if you have an abnormal biopsy of your intestine, you have celiac. Otherwise, you don't. So don't worry about it.
Right. But so there's a whole nother area of gluten sensitivity. And for many people, it's making them really sick, even if it's not celiac. I also think there's something going on with the quality of gluten. You know, I saw it years ago and I had so many folks telling me when they came back, like, oh, you know, I was eating pasta in Italy. I was eating bread in France and I was fine. And I come back here and I get so sick.
Yeah.
So that's part of this epidemic of what we're seeing of gluten sensitivity. Is it, you know, they hybridized it, went back in the 50s and added more gluten. Many of our breads, they put more gluten in it. Gluten is what makes bread spongy. So you put it in there and you get these nice big loaves of bread and, you know, more is better in this country. So I think that's a part of it. We spray it with glyphosate and various pesticides and there's a good chance people are reacting to that.
That destroys the microbiome.
Exactly. So once you muck up with the gut microbiome, you're going to have a lot of digestive and other issues. So that I definitely think is, I can't tell you how many people tell me I eat it abroad and I'm fine. Not our celiac folks, but many other folks that are really sensitive. So the spectrum is what is being missed, I think, in conventional medicine. Yeah. And, you know, I
just want to underscore what you just said. There are some key reasons why we're seeing this increase. So one, it's the change in the kind of wheat we're eating, right? They've hybridized it. The dwarf wheat has way more gluten proteins and the way more inflammatory gluten proteins than heirloom wheat.
Right.
You spray it with glyphosate, which not all wheat is full of glyphosate, but a lot of it is. Mm-hmm. And that causes damage to your gut, which causes more leaky gut and more gluten
reactivity.
Reactions. Yep. It also is sprayed with, in the preservative, when it's put in the bread, called calcium propionate, which is actually a toxin that causes problems with behavior and attention and focus. So it can cause a lot of brain issues for people.
Right.
So you, and then on top of that, we've created a background level of dysfunction in our gut over the last decades by our poor quality diet, starch, sugar, low fiber, processed food, which damage our microbiome, makes it more likely we have a leaky gut. We've taken antibiotics, we take acid blocking drugs, we take steroids, we take hormones, all of which mess up our gut. We have increased rates of C-section, increased rates of bottle feeding. All these things make your gut more likely to become
gluten sensitive. Right, sets you up to become more sensitive.
So that's why we're seeing this sort of escalation of gluten sensitivity over the last 50 years, and it's real.
Right. And, you know, not many of us are eating these like whole wheat berries. I mean, we're eating in the form of flour. So even if you get organic, you know, bread, whole grain bread, I mean, it's still refined carbohydrates. Yeah. And you're selectively feeding things in your gut you probably don't want to be feeding too much and throwing off your blood sugars. So when people go gluten-free, I do think part of the reason they feel better, as long as they don't start eating a lot of gluten-free junk, is they transition over to more whole carbohydrates, whole foods.
Yeah.
And they feel a lot better for that reason too. So for that reason, you know.
Gluten-free junk food is still junk food. Cookies, if it's gluten-free, is still cake and cookies.
Right, exactly. So I really wanted to bring attention to that because we see, I can't tell you how many symptoms I've seen get better, you know, not across the board, but just I've had brain fog get better taking gluten out. I've had joint pain get better. I've had skin get better. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people joke around, like, do you take everyone off of gluten? I'm like, if you saw how many people got better off of gluten, you take it, you know,
well,
take it out of their diet
we
too.
See people who come to see us who are ill.
Yeah, right.
And so we have a select, we call selection bias. But I would say, you know, when people walk in the door with any kind of chronic illness, for me, checking gluten antibodies and what we call a Cyrex-3 test, which we'll get into, which looks at way more proteins around gluten, is like checking their blood pressure.
Yeah.
Or their temperature.
Right.
It's a vital sign for me because it's so common. It's such a big deal. And, you know, I just saw this guy the other day who had all this severe lymphedema and inflammation in his body. And he had one of the worst gluten tests I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And he didn't know it. And he's like 50 years old.
Yeah.
So anytime anybody comes in with a chronic issue that's not getting better, especially anything that's inflammatory or digestive in any way or neurologic, it's the first thing I look at.
Yeah. And I think the question I get a lot too is like, well, why was I okay eating gluten through, you know, my younger years? And why is it an issue now? And I'm like, well, even with celiac, right? That's a genetic condition. You're technically born with it, but when it develops can really vary. So you need to have like the genetic predisposition, gluten in your diet, and some type of trigger.
Yeah.
So an infection, you know, a really stressful event, you know, toxins again.
Yeah.
Something has compromised your gut lining and now you're reacting to these proteins. So for some people, it might not even be a life sentence. I mean, if they have celiac or something similar, they have to be really careful. But other people, sometimes if you get the gut sorted out and healed, they can tolerate some
of
these
when I was really
proteins.
Sick with mercury poisoning and when I was really sick and had gut issues, I couldn't eat any gluten. And now, I mean, I don't eat a lot, but now it doesn't really bother me and I don't really have antibodies because I fixed my gut.
Right.
And I think we see a lot of these patients who, you know, may not have any symptoms for years and years, like you said. And then when they're 50, they get an autoimmune disease or they get something. And you check and they have celiac. They actually have celiac or they have really severe gluten sensitivity. And I think, you know, you say it's genetic. About 30%+ of the population has the gene for celiac.
Right.
But only 1% get it. And I think it's all the things you're saying. It's all these insults that are from the environment, our diet, antibiotics, et cetera, that make us susceptible.
Right. Your genes are never going to say you're going to get that disease. It's usually your environment that needs to turn those genes on. So yeah, it's true. And even though you have the genetics, it doesn't mean that it's not a way to diagnose for it, but it's good to know your genetics.
And it's a spectrum, you know, like you look at the antibody test and there's a normal level, right? Like there's, you know, 0 to 20 or whatever on the antibody test on your blood level. But when you think about it, there is no normal level of antibodies to gluten in your blood, right? And you talk to Dr. Alessio Fasano, who's been on the podcast, who's the world's expert in gluten at Harvard and brilliant guy. And he said, you know, look, if you have any antibodies, it means three things. One, you've been eating wheat or gluten. Two, you have a leaky gut. And three, your immune system doesn't like it.
Right. Right.
So if the level is five, it's not as bad as 20, but it's not as good as zero.
Right. And you don't want to go to 20. Right.
And so why don't right. So a lot now. Of people say, oh, my tests are fine. But they may, it's a spectrum. It's a continuum. It's not on or off.
Right.
And it's always worth doing an elimination diet because the cost is low. The benefit's high. There's really no downside to getting off it for 6 weeks, let's say, or even 2 weeks and seeing what you'd feel like. And if your symptoms get better and then you eat it again and you feel worse, there's your answer.
Right, right. I think it's a little tricky too, though, with gluten, because typically with an elimination diet, you know, use 2 to 3 weeks off of that food, you should feel better. We've had a lot of people where it's up to 3 months.
3 months,
right?
Yes,
before
3 months.
I saw it clinically for a while, and now that we're testing for it more, you see these antibodies to gluten stay around for a long time after someone's been off of it, right? If you're no longer getting exposure, those antibodies should come down, the inflammation should come down. So that's something to keep in mind for listeners, because I've had a lot of people say, you know, I went gluten-free for 3 weeks and I didn't feel all that much different. And then I'm like, I think you got to give it longer. It's around that 3 month mark that a lot of people like, you know, my joints finally started feeling better around that point. So that's something to keep in mind.
I had a patient when she was off for 10 weeks before she started to feel better with psoriatic arthritis. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, usually it's a combination of a few other things that need to be sorted out, but you know, you really want to give yourself a good time period. So if you've never done up to 3 months, you should. And, you know, it sneaks in a lot of places, which we'll talk about, but you know, most folks who are fairly sensitive have to be 100%+ off of it. Yeah. Or they will still be reactive.
And it's 150%.
I mean,
if people have, Dr. Fasano said to me once, is if you have a thumbnail full of gluten in 3 months, you're back to zero.
Yeah.
Like you can't even cheat a little bit if you want to do it, because your body then creates an immune response. Right. And I remember a patient who had rheumatoid arthritis and she was very, you know, good, but, you know, she was trying all the functional medicine stuff. She would get a little bit better. She wasn't cutting it. And I said, look, you think you're gluten-free? And I went through a diet and she was getting some, and maybe she had some soy milk with barley malt and this and that. So I said, why don't we put you on just a 10-day Ultra Clear Plus shake, which is what we're using back then, mm-hmm. which is basically a rice protein, low allergenic, just no other food, just this shake for 10 days, see what happens. Everything went away.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, you know? And I think I saw her like 3 months later, 6 months later, and she'd completely changed. She lost 40 pounds, her arthritis was gone. She felt great.
Right.
And I think, you know, one of the things I just want to emphasize is that whatever condition you have, almost anything really in medicine, it should be on your list of things to think about.
Right.
Because when you look, for example, the New England Journal of Medicine had an article years ago, which listed over 55 different diseases that were really caused by celiac and gluten, mm-hmm. but we're masquerading as something else.
Right.
Osteoporosis, iron deficiency, schizophrenia, autism, cancers, you know, you name it, autoimmune diseases, mm-hmm. migraines. I mean, just disease after disease. And if you really look at that list, and that's just, I think, a short list compared to things I've seen over the last 30 years, you're going to think that pretty much anybody who has a serious chronic illness or has chronic symptoms or it's just not feeling great, should check for it and also should try an elimination diet.
Right, right. And this is where too testing can be helpful, because there's some people that think they're 100% off of it. You know, I've had several folks come in already knowing they have celiac or very sensitive and they're off of gluten. We still test them. And the antibodies that we're looking for, this is through the Cyrex 3 panel that we do. There's about 32 different immune markers that they're looking at various parts of the gluten protein and wheat and other proteins within wheat. But so it's a very sensitive test. And these antibodies shouldn't be in your system if you have not been eating gluten and they come back positive. Yeah. And that's like, okay, you're getting some hidden sources. When you eat out, are you, you know, doing all the precautions you need to do? Have you checked your body care products? Is your house gluten-free? There's so much contamination that happens in the house of, you know, not everyone in the house is gluten-free and they're sharing space and food. So this is where you have, the testing can be really helpful to kind of dig in. And again, traces can make a difference, even if you don't have celiac for someone that's really sensitive.
So tell us about like some of the common things we see. One of the cases you have is a thyroid
issue. So I wanted to kind of focus on autoimmunity because that's a lot. Anytime I see someone with an autoimmune condition, if they're not gluten-free, I'm like, you got to start there just to make sure that's not triggering it. Because again, even if you don't have celiac.
I want to emphasize what you said. Anybody who has an autoimmune disease, gluten should be on your list
absolutely
of what to check and what to eliminate it is easy to do and you can have profound results.
Absolutely. Yeah, because even if you don't have the celiac, what we so often find is that when you take gluten out, these other like antibodies to the thyroid, other conditions of autoimmune conditions, they get better. The numbers start getting better. So we've seen that clinically and now we're, you know, we test for it so much more. So even if you don't have celiac, we do find it can trigger a lot of other autoimmune like conditions. So that's, I was kind of wanting to focus on two cases around autoimmunity. The first one is a 38-year-old woman with Hashimoto's, which is the autoimmune condition you can get with your thyroid, very common and a lot of reasons to have it. But she was interesting. She was a really intense triathlete, so very competitive, high exercise person. She came with severe fatigue just in for nutrition, because I think she, you know, want to focus on nutrition and weight loss, which is not typically what you see with low thyroid function. But her thyroid antibodies were extremely high, some of the highest I've ever seen. And she also had a liver enzyme that was elevated too. So I was, you know, wondering if there maybe was a toxicity component to that. And I do think she was a bit malnourished given the high level of exercise that she does. Some of her nutrition labs, like even her cholesterol was coming back low, which could indicate that she wasn't getting all the nutrition or maybe not absorbing all the nutrition she needs. So I, you know, like I always do with autoimmune, I'm like, let's take all the gluten out. She kind of did her own research and went full on paleo, which takes out all the grains and all the legumes, which sometimes really can make a difference for folks that are gluten sensitive. And I really focused, again, getting enough good fats and protein, good quality carbohydrates in her diet. With the exercise piece, you know, I was thinking there could be an adrenal component to that. And your adrenals are very closely linked to your thyroid. So she, you know, worked on some other lifestyle things and did some yoga and restorative stuff that I think was important.
But you know, when you see Hashimoto's, which is very common, right? One in five women have low thyroid. A lot of that is autoimmune thyroid conditions, probably the most common autoimmune disease in the country. You know, it's not all related to gluten, but probably I would say a third of my patients who have Hashimoto's, when I check their gluten antibodies, are elevated.
Right. It's a piece of the puzzle, right?
And when they get off gluten, they get better.
Right. Exactly. It's so often a piece of the puzzle. It's usually not the only thing, but it's definitely a big component for a lot of folks. And, you know, again, being a high level triathlete, your digestive system takes a hit to that, you know, and I think she got a little bit of leaky gut where before the gluten may not have been an issue. Yeah. And she'd also had a daughter soon before. And, you know, sometimes just the process of going through a pregnancy can switch what goes on with the immune system as
and
well.
And on her blood test, she found elevated.
Yeah. So I had her, you know, she didn't do any specialty testing with us. I just had her, she had a good local doctor who did more integrative stuff. And I said, have them do a celiac panel and not just check tissue transglutaminase, which is what the kind of the gold standard, so to say, right, for blood work is for celiac. You can check for antibodies to gliadin, which is part of the gluten protein. You could check for deaminated gliadin. So I wrote out what to ask her doctor for and they ran it. And she did not have the tissue transglutaminase, which, right, mostly is what they're going to look for for celiac. But she did have anti-gliadin antibodies. And I was like, you should not have those, you know? So you may not have celiac, but you could have something similar.
So yeah, so that's a good point, because a lot of doctors will check the basic test and they say you're fine. And they only check like one antibody called TTG.
Right.
But they don't check the anti-gliadin antibodies, which are less specific, but actually more sensitive. So they'll they'll show up often when the other one doesn't.
Right, right.
And they do indicate a level of leaky gut, a level of gluten sensitivity, and they are definitely contributing to all sorts of issues for people.
Right. And we did some other nutritional stuff. She was low in iodine and we did some, you know, sea vegetables and things, which is important for thyroid. So again, there's other things that are going on. But that, you know, when I had a 2-year follow-up with her, obviously we had a few follow-ups in between, but she said her digestion was great. Her energy was great. Her thyroid antibodies, and you know, what I think we hear in conventional medicine is like, you got autoimmunity, you have it. You know, why check antibodies? It doesn't go away. So her thyroid peroxidase, which is one of the ones they check, came down to less than zero, whatever the normal is. And her thyroglobulin antibody, which is the other one, is slightly elevated, but came down significantly.
So that's remarkable. So she had one of the highest levels of autoimmune antibodies you'd ever seen. And after getting her gut sorted and getting the gluten out of her diet and optimizing her nutritional status.
Doing stress reduction.
She actually had a complete normalization of one of them and almost normal the other one.
Right.
Which, quote, doesn't happen in traditional medicine.
And she's on Armour. She's on some thyroid support. She does feel better with it. And I think there's, you know, often a need for it. But, you know, she pretty much reversed her autoimmunity by going paleo.
That's amazing.
So that was pretty remarkable. It's nice to see when things, you know, kind of quickly turn around for some folks.
What about this other case you had?
So this other one was a bit more complicated. She's a young woman, 27 years old, but she has mixed connective tissue disease, which, you know, is kind of a combination of, you know, similar to lupus or scleroderma. It's kind of a mix of where autoimmunity can affect many different tissues.
Yeah, so it's a bad autoimmune
disease. It
affects like all the tissues and organs and skin and liver and kidneys and muscles and so.
And then she came in with all those symptoms, you know, a ton of joint pain. She had a lot of digestive stuff, which she said she kind of always had her whole life. Fatigue. She was depressed. She had weight gain, probably because she was so inflamed. She wanted to lose about 20 pounds or so. And her symptoms did start in her teens with some, you know, exercise stuff. And then by the time she came to see us, again, only just in her 20s, she was getting arthritis in her hands. So she was on autoimmune suppressant medication. She was on CellCept, but she had been on a lot of things over the years. Omeprazole for her reflux because she had a lot of the digestion issues. She was on a low gluten diet.
Yeah, yeah, that doesn't count.
That's what I always talk to people. What is
it's like
low?
Being a little bit pregnant.
What is low gluten? I was like, you have all these conditions. You have to take gluten out. And she had done testing. I think some specialty tests that did show she was reactive to gluten and soy before. And that's why she was low. But I told her, you know, you got to be 100%. And she said, you know, I do feel like my headaches are worse and my stomach's worse when I have gluten. So we got her strict gluten-free, you know, I kind of low grain. I try to get it low allergen overall. I told her to come off the coffee, no alcohol, anything else that could be inflammatory to her gut.
And you also did this test, which was not the normal test. So,
right.
So you mentioned a little bit earlier. So when you go to the traditional doctor, they'll do a celiac panel. They'll do the TTG. They'll do sometimes gliadin antibodies. But we at the Ultra Wellness Center do a different test from the lab called Cyrex, which looks at not just a few proteins in the wheat, but all sorts of different, like dozens of
the gliadins, glutenins, or different parts of the gluten protein. So they're breaking them down to these smaller units so you can really get a closer, you know, look at what the immune system's reacting to. And there's a section there of transglutaminase. So it's not the same thing as tissue transglutaminase. You can't diagnose celiac with it. But what Cyrex says is that folks that have these other transglutaminase reactions are more likely to have an autoimmune condition related to gluten. Mm. So this is where it's like, okay, it may not be celiac, but you probably have something very similar. So out of 32 markers, 30 of them came back positive on a low gluten diet. I mean, she wasn't eating a standard American diet at all. She did have a celiac panel. Her tissue transglutaminase, again, that gold standard was borderline high, which it should not really be showing anything. And her deaminated gliadin was high. She did have the genetics. She had, it's called HLA DQ2 and DQ8. The DQ2 is positive, which brings your risk up pretty high for celiac. We also did a Cyrex 4, which is known as kind of their autoimmune profile as well. So they're looking at dairy. Dairy we know is big allergen in and of itself, but a lot of people that react to gluten seem to react to dairy.
Yeah.
And they've, you know, with paleo, a lot of folks take out all grains and sometimes that is helpful. According to Cyrex research, oats have been identified a long time ago. Even when they're gluten-free, when they're not contaminated with gluten, there is a protein in there very close in structure to gluten. So many people do react to it.
I see that a lot. I mean, I'm on the gluten-free oats and I'm like, nope.
Yeah, usually
If you are still having any symptoms, then you should just get rid of all the oats.
Yeah, so I tend to throw oats in the gluten category. And then they also suspect rice, which I've always thought of as a low allergen grain, but we do have a lot of folks that seem reactive to rice, corn, and millet. So those are the ones I kind of focus on. They also check corn, soy, some of these other common allergens.
Yeah, and so what happens is, you know, the way I think about it is gluten is sort of the gatekeeper, right? When you eat gluten, you become sensitive to it. It opens up the channels in the gut, creating what we call a leaky gut. And then other foods get in and you get these cross reactions. So you get other grains, you get dairy, you get soy, but it's really the gluten that's sort of started the whole thing.
Right.
And if you fix the gluten and you heal the gut and you get rid of all those other foods for a short time, maybe 3 months, 6 months, maybe a year, you can heal the leaky gut and then become able to tolerate a much wider diet.
Absolutely. So I think that's a fear of so many people when they start reacting to so many things. I'm like, you know, a lot of these foods are not at fault. You know, there's something else compromising your gut.
Like the
maybe
innocent
gluten.
Bystander.
What's that?
It's like the innocent bystander.
Yeah. And I'm like, once that gut gets healthy, you know, your immune system's not going to be seeing it and reacting as much. And she, because she was on these immunosuppressants, we did a different type of leaky gut test called the mannitol lactulose test, which basically looks what's leaking through the gut. And she did come back with increased permeability between the cells that line the digestive tract. So, you know, this is the gut is where you need to focus for autoimmunity because so much of the immune system lines that. So if that's not healthy and it's leaky, that's probably what's triggering autoimmunity for folks.
We used to think that fat was bad. And it's sort of a legacy of why we started to get into this sort of carbohydrate binge, essentially, was based on very poor science in the 60s that showed that fat was the cause of heart disease. But it really was very poor science. It was observational data. It was cherry-picked data. They actually didn't look at the randomized controlled trials when they came up with the dietary guidelines, which actually didn't show that it was harmful, that fat was harmful. So back in the 70s, you know, we were finally looking at the link between diet and disease in America, and the McGovern Report, George McGovern, created dietary guidelines for Americans, which basically stated that we should be cutting out the fat and increasing the carbohydrate content of our diet. And then we got the food pyramid in 1992, which showed we should have 6 to 11 servings of bread, rice, cereal, and pasta a day, which is, when you look at the graphs of that period of time and the obesity pandemic, we see that is exactly when the hockey stick rise in obesity and diabetes came in. So it's the worst possible thing that happened to us. And, you know, we really need to think about how we should, if we're going to eat carbohydrates or bread, we have to rethink bread entirely. When you look at modern bread, it's extremely finely milled flour and with a lot of surface area. So when you consume it, it's quickly absorbed, just like sugar. And in fact, I guess it's worse than sugar in terms of its glycemic index. And that causes you to spike insulin levels. After your blood sugar goes up, your insulin spikes. And that insulin spike causes a cascade of phenomena that leads to all the chronic diseases we see, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, and much more. Infertility, I mean, I could go on and on, acne. And that phenomena of insulin resistance is driving inflammation in the body. It causes you to store fat around the middle. It causes you to crave more carbohydrates in food. It causes you to eat more overall. It slows your metabolism down. It really is a hormonal immune catastrophe. And that's really because of the kind of flour we're eating. So we really need to cut that out if we want to stay healthy. It doesn't mean we can't have different kinds of bread. And there's many kinds of bread. And in Food, What the Heck Should I Cook, which is my cookbook, there's a couple of great recipes for seed and nut breads. There's other breads like Lynn's Life, which are made from just, you know, pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, flax seeds, psyllium husks, eggs, and little almond milk and lemon juice and baking soda. And it's delicious bread, but it's not made from flour. It's made from nuts and seeds. So I think we really can reimagine bread. And also that we can look at all kinds of other grains that might be helpful and beneficial and are rich in phytochemicals. Because basically when you're eating modern white flour, it's just completely devoid of any nutrients. And the reason they call it enriched flour is because when they first started making it and people started eating it, they would get massive nutritional deficiencies because of the lack of the B vitamins that are in the whole grain. So they would get thiamine deficiency, beriberi, pellagra, you know, it was a terrible time of vitamin deficiency. And it was because of the refining of the flour. That's how we began to actually discover the vitamins, because when we started milling the flour so fine, whether it was rice or whether it's other grains or flour, we saw this massive rise in really serious nutritional vitamin deficiencies. People don't think of, oh, I'm eating a bagel or I'm having a, you know, a piece of bread with dinner, then I'm actually harming myself. But the truth is we are really harming ourselves when we have white flour. We eat 133 pounds of flour per person per year. That's like a little, like a third of a pound a day, basically, or a little more, right? That's a lot of flour. The second is just this phenomena of increased gliadin proteins in gluten and the number of gluten proteins that are inflammatory. And that it combined with all the other stressors in our life that cause leaky gut, from environmental toxins to food additives to chronic stress to, you know, microbiome changes and antibiotic use and other medication. You know, we're in a situation where we're seeing rampant leaky gut. And gluten is one of the biggest drivers of leaky gut because it creates a damage to what we call the tight junctions, which are the little sort of Lego lock kind of things that put the cells together. And when you consume gluten, this is work by Alessio Fasano from Harvard, who discovered that it increases a compound called zonulin in the body, in the gut. Zonulin is a very important molecule that will
cause a weakening of the tight junctions. And it can be helpful. Like, you know, if you get certain infections or diseases, you want to flush the gut out. But this actually creates this chronic leaky gut, and you absorb all the bacterial toxins and food proteins, and you can get inflammation in the body and autoimmune disease and allergies and much worse. So I think, you know, that those two things, both the sugar content and the leaky gut damage from gluten and bread, is the two biggest real threats. You know, all of us to some degree have some permeability in our gut, and the more wheat we eat, the more permeable it is. But not all of us are sick, and it's a subtle dynamic that we have to be in balance with. However, if you are suffering from allergies, autoimmune disease, asthma, you know, migraines, irritable bowel, reflux, all these chronic illnesses, they really can be linked to leaky gut. Even obesity, heart disease, dementia, all of those things can be linked to damage and leaky gut because it's inflammation. But even cause inflammation will cause you to have these chronic illnesses. So leaky gut and the inflammation that's a consequence of that, plus the effect of the sugar content of bread on our biology, are the two biggest threats that we face today from eating bread. Most of the bread we eat is from regular wheat, dwarf wheat flour. It's highly refined and it's quickly leavened, and it's made into all kinds of bread products that often have added sugar and high fructose corn syrup, and it's bad. No one should ever really eat that. I hate to say it. Then, you know, sourdough bread, if you're getting, for example, maybe an heirloom grain, or you get your flour from an organic non-dwarf wheat source, more heirloom grain, there's einkorn wheat, there's kernza wheat, which is a new strain of wheat developed. Sourdough bread can be very good because it helps to digest the enzymes that may make gluten less of an issue. It's easier to digest. And it's been used for thousands of years with sourdough starters. So that's sort of an upgrade and improvement, but it really depends on the flour you're starting with. If you start off with crappy flour and white flour from dwarf wheat, it's not a good idea. And then there's you know, some interesting things where we see in Europe, when people go to Europe, they don't have the same intolerance to wheat that they do in this country. And there they don't actually use the same wheat. They don't use dwarf wheat. And they also, their process of making bread is not like a quick, you know, 1 hour leavening. And they may leaven it for 12 hours overnight. And that changes the composition of the proteins and this gluten and allows it to be less reactive. And then there's, you know, all sorts of other sort of grains that you can use that contain gluten. Like in Germany, my favorite breads are those German rye breads or whole grain breads. And they're not made from flour. They're made from whole grains. So essentially you get a meat slicer to cut it because it's so thick. If you stood on it, it wouldn't squish at all. And you can't cut it with a regular knife because it's too dense. That's really great bread. So nobody's really made that here, but that's made from whole kernel grains. And so, you know, whether you're looking at, you know, sort of trying other kinds of gluten grains like spelt or rye or certain oats, I mean, you may be able to tolerate those, or you might not tolerate the dwarf wheat that is the prevalent wheat in this country. But my typical philosophy is, you know, if you're not celiac and you're not non-celiac gluten sensitivity, or you don't have a wheat allergy, that you probably should minimize your intake of wheat in general. Although you can have, if you have some of these other forms of sourdough or German rye or einkorn wheat, or you can make your own, that's probably okay from time to time. But again, it also depends on, you know, how dense the bread is, how milled it is, how thin the flour is. Because forget about gluten sensitivity, if you're dealing with weight and metabolic issues, which is almost 9 out of 10 Americans, it's the devil. You know, it just spikes your blood sugar, spikes your insulin, makes you gain weight, more inflammation, and you end up in the vicious cycle. What is the Wolf's Protocol? What is the concept of the diet? Why are the principles of the diet used in the way they are? And what are the key take homes around that? And let's get into the research of how this works.
So first we'll talk about the dietary approach. So the way you might think about it when I talk to the public is sort of a pre-Walls diet is a Mediterranean diet, which everyone agrees is a great diet. More vegetables, legumes, more fish. So nice, healthy diet. The first level of my diet, we have people stress. And the goal is 9 cups of vegetables, 3 cups of greens, 3 cups of sulfur-rich vegetables in the cabbage, onion, mushroom family, and 3 cups of deeply colored things like beets, carrots, berries. And then I want them to remove gluten, casein, and eggs, because they're the 3 most common food antigens that can cause an excessive immune response.
Well, no more waffles.
No more waffles.
You actually know what? I make cashew waffles. I make all kinds of great things. You can kind of cheat.
There are things you can do. So that's the first level. And you can do that as a vegetarian. And that is fairly close to a gluten-free, dairy-free version of a Mediterranean diet. Then the next level is becomes more Paleolithic. So we reduce the gluten-free grains and legumes to no more than 2 servings a week. We add in and stress organ meats, seaweeds. If you're going to have nuts and seeds, we suggest that you have them soaked and sprouted.
And so why organ meats? Why organ meats? Because, you know, organ meats are something people avoid, right? Liver, kidneys, thymus.
Yeah, they don't know how to make them.
And they're actually delicious. It seems like the poor man's food, you know, steak and kidney pie. And
Yeah.
What's the rationale for the organ meats?
Well, first off, our ancestors would have eaten those. They're a third of the carcass when you harvest an animal. So that would have been an essential part of the diet. And interestingly enough, if there was plenty of meat, they left the muscle meat behind and took the organs. Mm-hmm. So the liver, great source of vitamin A and the fat-soluble vitamins, is so A, K, a moderate source of E, a great source of the B vitamins, a great source of minerals that are very easily absorbed, as opposed to the minerals in plants, which are a little more difficult for us to absorb. And then great source of coenzyme Q, creatine, carnitine. Yeah. So really, really marvelous nutrition for us.
And a lot of those are mitochondrial nutrients, right?
They are mitochondrial nutrients.
And which is so important for healthy aging and everything. You know, Terry, it's interesting because if you look at, I've done this before, you Google like liver nutrition facts, right? And then like, and then the nutrition facts for the most
kale.
Amazing vegetable you could possibly imagine, or grain or bean. And it's like Michael Jordan and high school basketball. It's like, it's that big of a difference. It's shocking. It's like, not just a little bit, it's like 3, 4, 5, 10 orders of magnitude more nutrients in liver than in almost any other food.
Correct. Absolutely.
Which is so liver shocking.
Is absolutely a superfood. The one nutrient it does not have is vitamin C.
That's all right.
So that's a good reason to eat your salads and your berries to get the vitamin C. Now, the caveat I'll have is for my carnivore friends who eat only meat, I have to caution them to be careful about how much liver they have, because you don't want to overdose on vitamin A. So liver is really great for you, 6 to 8 ounces a week. So that's, you know, up to a half pound of liver a week.
And yeah, the First Nation people up in Alaska, and they actually would give it to the explorers because they wanted to kill them. So they give them polar bear liver, and they literally die. They die from vitamin A poisoning.
So liver is really great. It is our family's favorite dish. So my family makes liver for me on my birthday because they know it's a special meal for us. We just really love that a lot.
For me, it was a poor man's meal because we were very poor in New York City when I lived as a kid with my mom, and we would live in this tiny one bedroom apartment, and we'd have liver and onions and rice. And I thought that was like a fancy meal, chicken liver. And you realize it was like, because we're poor.
It is actually quite handy because it is relatively inexpensive. You can get organic liver very inexpensively because the market doesn't understand how valuable that nutrition is. Another really great organ meat, of course, is heart. Heart is sort of like filet mignon. That is just so delicious, incredibly delicious. And then, you know, oysters, clams, mussels, those are all organ meats.
Oh, really?
Quite delicious.
What about the liver toxicity, like of liver? Because people say, liver is not the wastebasket of the body, where the toxins go. Isn't it bad to eat that?
So where the toxins go is really the fat of the animal. So people like bacon. So if you're worried about toxicities, be sure that your bacon is organic. And if you're concerned about
toxicities, liver is fatty.
Liver is fatty. I would certainly have it be organic. Hmm. And I think that is prudent. My preference is you know, have liver, get it from an organic animal.
So, so Terry, just to summarize the dietary principles, it's getting rid of gluten, dairy, and eggs. Getting rid of grains and beans. It's getting rid of, obviously, all processed food, sugar, alcohol.
Sugars.
Right.
More vegetables.
Lots more vegetables. And tell us about your like 9 cups of vegetables and the different kinds of vegetable categories. Because I think it's really important to help you understand. It's not just any vegetable that you need. You need vegetables that contain certain compounds, which are medicines
for
your body.
So we want to have lots of greens. Greens are a great source of carotenoids, lutein, zeaxanthin, meoszeaxanthin. These are essential nutrients for your retina and also for your brain, because your eyes are really just extensions of brains. They'll reduce the risk of macular degeneration, of cataracts, and dementia. You're also going to get a great source of vitamin K. And in neuroimmune conditions, MS, and cognitive decline, there's a severe, in epidemiologic studies, the vitamin K levels are extraordinarily low in those population groups. So lots of reasons to get your greens. Now we're going to go on to why I want you to have cabbage, onion, mushrooms. So the sulfur is a really great support for your detox, great support for making glutathione, you know, intracellular antioxidants, great support for your mitochondria.
Also, and that's the broccoli family.
In the onion family.
Yes.
Also good for your blood vessel endothelial function. And then mushrooms. There are a wide variety of mushrooms that stimulate your natural killer cells, priming your adaptive and innate immunity. They also are associated with better nerve growth factor production in animal models. And in human studies, associated with much lower rates of cognitive decline and depression.
Wow. Well, I feel good about taking my mushroom powders every morning.
So take your mushrooms. I have mushrooms in my tea every day. So
amazing.
Lots of Great. Reasons to have your mushrooms.
Okay, so that's the food part. Now you've taken this approach.
No. You didn't get the colors yet. So
we're also
3 cups of colors. And I want to have a wide.
Okay, wait. Before you go on. So the government says 5 to 9 servings. A serving is half a cup. So you're talking about not 5 to 9. You're talking about 18 cups. Just so people get the idea.
Well, nine cups.
18 servings. Nine cups, 18 servings, right.
You know, and I'm not trying to have you eat more than what your appetite will allow you. The point I'm trying to have you do is you eat some your protein, and we have strategies for vegetarians or meat eaters, and you eat lots of vegetables. You don't need to be hungry, but you're not eating junk.
Mm-hmm.
When you're hungry, you're eating these vegetables, and mm-hmm. we want to have sufficient protein and lots of vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you do that, you're going to poop. And of course, we have to make modifications for people who have inflammatory bowel disease, who can't have as much fiber. When we talk about this, Mark, this is for the public. This is for what you start. And then you assess your response. And if you're having loose stools, you're going to have less fiber. If you're still constipation, more fiber, more fermented foods, more sauerkraut and kimchi.
Thanks for listening today. If you love this podcast, please share it with your friends and family. We'd love to hear your comments and your questions, and please leave us a rating and review. And of course, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can find me on all social media channels at Dr. Mark Hyman, and you can also subscribe to my YouTube channel at Dr. Mark Hyman. I'm always getting questions about my favorite books, podcasts, gadgets, supplements, recipes, and lots more. And now you can have access to all of this information by signing up for my free Mark's Picks newsletter at drhyman.com/Mark's Picks. I promise I'll only email you once a week on Fridays, and I'll never share your email address or send you anything else besides my recommendations. These are the things that have helped me on my health journey, and I hope they'll help you too. Again, that's drhyman.com/Mark's Picks. Thank you again, and we'll see you next time on The Doctor's Pharmacy. This podcast is separate from my clinical practice at the Ultra Wellness Center and my work at Cleveland Clinic and Function Health, where I'm the chief medical officer.
This podcast represents my opinions and my guests' opinions, and neither myself nor the podcast endorses the views or statements of my guests. This podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or other qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. Now, if you're looking for your help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. You can come see us at the Ultra Wellness Center in Lenox, Massachusetts. Just go to ultrawellnesscenter.com. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner near you, you can visit ifm.org and search Find a Practitioner database. It's important that you have someone in your corner who is trained, who is a licensed healthcare practitioner, and can help you make changes, especially when it comes to your health. Keeping this podcast free is part of my mission to bring practical ways of improving health to the general public. In keeping with that theme, I'd like to express gratitude to the sponsors that made today's podcast possible.